You've coached 1,500 teams in the last 5 years, right?
Right.
And many of them are also experienced startups, right?
Yes, some have just an idea and they're just trying to develop the idea, but the majority have either raised some funds already and they're looking for, or they have some seed funding and they're looking for the Series A, or majority of them have something already going for them.
So what's the basic thing that you would say in one sentence that you try to teach them?
I teach them or model for them and show them, explain to them how to express the value of their technology and product or service in a really compelling way so people listening, the investors listening, understand what the value is and want to talk to them after their pitch.
I assume that prior to meeting you, founders, startups, presenters already do some research on how to present, because once they reach you, they've probably already convinced someone at least. And you know, the basic rules seem rather straightforward. Be concise, be short, be confident, and tell a story. So what is it that startups usually don't understand or are not very good at?
Well, the four things that you just mentioned are actually not what all of what investors need to hear. So what they're not good at, or what they aren't aware of, most founders and entrepreneurs, is what to say and what not to say. And so they don't know what their audience is interested in hearing. You know, there's basically 10 things that they have to sort of cover in a 5-minute pitch. If they have a minute or 2 minutes, then they have to know which key things they have to say. They also don't have the words sort of scripted or fine-tuned enough to represent the value of what they're doing clearly. They're not clear about, you know, what the problem is that they're solving for out there, and the phrase or the words to describe it really succinctly and powerfully. And they're also not clear about what parts of what they're doing are unnecessary to talk about. So they tell too many details, and they don't include what some of the things the investor needs to hear. What do they need to hear? They have to understand, like, what's the current situation, right, that they can relate to. They also need to hear what's unique or differentiated technology. Can you defend it? Do you have IP, patents? And they need to hear what the market is. What's their initial target market? Do they have traction in the market? Do they have clients already? Which is what they want to know. And they want to know about the team, like, who is this team? Because no matter how good your technology is, if the team isn't what they think it should be, they could either take you on, fund you, but also then supplement with people that they think could add to your team. Or if they don't feel like you're the right team, they're not going to fund you. The team is really, really important. And then they want to understand your go-to-market strategy. And if you don't have a go-to-market strategy, they're not going to fund you. And they are also very interested in hearing your business model. How are you going to make money? So it's like, what risk is associated with, you know, your product or technology in the market, and how are you going to make money? And then they want to have this compelling story. It's like they want to be sort of wowed by you, so because they're going to spend a long time in relationship with you. You know, it takes 6 years, 6 to 10 years to sort of exit, right? Mm-hmm. So they have to feel like they can, that you're coachable, that you're bright, that you're really going to have a really big impact, and that you understand what it takes and what you need to do. And that's what I help the entrepreneurs convey.
When you had a short presentation here in Ljubljana for the startup community, you mentioned that when you go on stage to pitch, you have approximately 15 to 30 seconds for the audience to decide whether or not they're going to listen to you or not.
Right, you have 10 to 30 seconds for them to decide whether you're worthwhile listening to or not. And if you don't grab their attention, they make that instantaneous, so very quick decision. If you lose their focus, their attention, you're sort of dead in the water.
Did you ever find anyone that was so difficult to work with that the best advice was that maybe somebody else from the team should present.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's not that they're difficult to work with. I've had a few people, yes, that are very, very difficult to work with. But I think more, it's just that certain people, if you have a very short time frame before you have to pitch, and it's a really important pitch, then you have to get your ego out of the way and decide who on your team is the best person to do that. And usually they like to hear from the founders of the company. That's their preference. But if you have a CTO, founder, COO, who can also represent it, and they're much better pitching, put them up there.
Has it ever happened to you that somebody pitched to you, came to you for advice, and the pitch was so good that you actually had to think, wow, this is something, it's perfect. What else can I do?
No, I've had a few people, I can count them on one hand, pitch to me, and they're really, really good, but there's always something that they can do to improve. One little thing, two things, and not too many, you know, very, very, very few out of all the companies that I've coached, you know, thousands. So
one of the advice I think heard often is tell a compelling story. So what happens then is that if the idea behind the company does not solve a very individual problem, the presenters start with an imaginary customer, you know, and then you have 10 pitches and all of them start with meet Mark, meet Tom. He has this and this problem, and this is how we're solving the problem.
Right.
How do you search for new ideas in terms of advising companies what is a good story and what is all over the place?
Well, the meet Tom, meet Mark, meet Jane, you know, is overused, and I don't have that many clients who use it, actually. And their stories, their own stories, come from partly from their own motivation, why they're doing what they're doing, their background, like what brought them to this point. But then it's like they saw an unmet need that they actually could do something about. They could have a positive impact on that would be profitable for everybody concerned. And that was because it's such a huge need. So they have to, in relating this story, what I do with them is I have them tell me, you know, why did you come to start developing this technology, the product, the service? Who are you? Who's your team? What is it that you're trying to solve for? And then as they're talking, we can see what sort of angle they need to sort of to present and include in their opening. And telling a story is not really accurate for what it is that they need to do in front of investors. Telling a story can sort of be sort of rambling. You can start and have this sort of an opening that doesn't really lead you immediately to where you need to go. When you're in front of investors, you need to sort of tell a one or two line opening that puts your audience immediately into your reality. What's the reality of your clients that you're serving? That not your personal reality, the client's personal reality that you're having. And once, and that type of story is different for each person because they have something unique that they are offering to a specific segment. So if you tell the story about that, everybody can relate to it. When I talked about like Bill Gates' example with the mosquitoes that he let out at the TED Talk quite a few years ago, he was doing two things with that. He was, instead of just telling people in the audience that, oh, you know, this many people in the world are dying from malaria or suffering from malaria, he gave them an experience by letting out the mosquitoes and saying, why should poor people be the only ones who get malaria? He gave them an experience of making the problem real so they could relate to what it was like for his potential customers and clients that he's trying to solve this problem for, what they're experiencing. That's powerful, right? So every technology, every entrepreneur has their own unique, powerful story. But it's a matter of asking enough questions to sort of have them talk about what it is they're doing to finally sort of hear and hone it down so that we can actually say, okay, that's it. And that's the phrase you should use. Let's how about this? Try it this way, try it that way. Okay, yes. And that's, I don't know, that's what I do with them.
How do you search for inspiration when it comes to framing the stories? And what would your advice be for startups? Where should they try to find help when they're preparing their pitch?
I think part of the issue in Europe that I found that I don't run into in the US as much is European startups are framing what they're solving for in too narrow and too small of a frame. So they're not looking big enough. They're not sort of expanding sort of to the longer view, global reach of what the problem is. So then they're looking too close in terms of time frames, too short in terms of time frame, too small of a community. They might be looking at just at their own country, not looking at how they can solve it across Europe, across in the U.S. or across the world. And so first you have to step back and say, who are you really solving? What's the problem you're really solving for? What's the problem? What's the current situation? And once they start talking about this is the current situation, these are the things that have happened, this is what the problems have been, this is why they don't have access to this, and I was working in the same field for years and I saw that this is what the problem, so I left us and I started my own startup so that I could actually, you know, worked on for a year. We worked on software that could actually sort of shorten their sales cycle for this so that they can actually get the medicine, you know, 300% or 300 times faster than the way they're getting it now. I mean, there's all that takes asking questions of the founders and getting them to sort of just talk, because most founders tell you what they're solving. They give you the solution, and they're telling you all the features that they have of what they've created. And that doesn't get anybody excited, because it's just information that doesn't touch people's heart. So they have to make sure that their head and their heart are connected, so when they're talking to their audience, which is venture capitalists or clients or partners, the information they're conveying is wrapped in the context of why the audience should care about it. So they understand it, they get it. And then they can see, oh, and that can make a lot of money. This can help a lot of people, right? And it could happen actually quite quickly, especially if the company, the CEO, the COO, CTO, CFO of the company have worked out a strategy and shown, you know, over the next 4 or 5 years, this is how we intend to grow the company. These are the markets we're currently in. These are the products we're going to be creating. This is how we're going to grow it over time. When entrepreneurs start their companies, they're focused on their initial technology and they're just trying to get that to work. So they're not thinking big enough out into the future enough and not about scaling it as much as they should. In Europe, that's what happens. People are much more modest in Europe about what they've achieved, what they could achieve, and all of the ecosystem around them isn't encouraging them to think bigger very easily. It's more like, well, no, you should be more conservative, the banks, etc. And I am the opposite, right? Because I come from California and Silicon Valley, and when I was coaching at Singularity University in Silicon Valley for a couple years in the summers at their graduate studies program, the thing that the entrepreneurs from all over the world, 80 of them from around the world who come there for the 10-week program, they're fearless. They're just going there to impact 1 billion people in 10 years in one of the 8 global challenge areas around energy, food, water, healthcare, poverty. Because the context and the frame of what they're doing is huge, they are immediately, you know, looking for huge solutions, but also they're going to the tops of whatever organizations are saying, look, this is what we've created, this is what we're trying to solve for, this is what we're working on, we, you know, we need help to do this. So they just go for it. And they, you know, if they get turned down, they just go to the next one. And in Europe, I find people are more hesitant. First of all, they don't think of doing it on that scale as easily. It's not ingrained in the psyche here. And second of all, when they do think of it and they try it on their own, they get slapped down. But I'm saying, well, yep, that's what happens, but you've got to sort of frame it, state it, articulate it slightly differently, because if you put it in the terms of trends, numbers, you know, how much money you're going to be making, you know, how you can grow it, the clients that you have. Well, that's the other thing, is that European startups they have traction in the market many times, but they don't tell anybody that they do. So they're talking to people, and they don't surface the key things that people want to know. They want to know that, What are you solving for? What's the problem? What is it that you've created? How is it better and different? And, you know, who's bought it so far? And it's you have to pull it. It's like pulling teeth. You know, it's not something that comes easily out of European mouths.
Yeah, absolutely. The culture here is much more conservative. There is much more skepticism.
Right.
So oftentimes when Europeans would listen to Americans, you know, they would not see the enthusiasm, but they would see exaggeration.
Right.
And they would feel it's just something...
Hot air.
Yes.
Not believable.
Yeah.
So the thing is that... In the 1 to 5 minute pitch, which is one of the things that I focus with my clients on, you have to put your best foot forward in the way I've been describing. All around the world, it's the same. But that second conversation, which is when the investor says, okay, yes, I want to meet with you, then you have to, in fact, factor in the cultural differences and adjust and adapt. And then, so then if you're in the U.S., you talk differently and, you know, handle yourself differently than you would in Europe or if you're in the Far East or other culture. But that 1 to 5 minute pitch, is, you've got to grab their attention so they understand what you've actually achieved. And it's true that in Europe, you know, people are more modest here in Europe. And in the U.S., they're more grandiose. And it's because in the U.S., if you're not, they're going to discount you about 25% anyway in the U.S. for what you say. So you have to, you know, sort of put your best case, best scenario, your ideal scenario forward, or because they're going to be cutting down on it anyway, thinking, okay, he says that, but. Whereas in Europe, they want you to put your most conservative scenario forward. And, of course, when you go to the U.S., if you do that as a European, they're not going to even talk to you because it's like, what? And so you have to not inflate it. You're not lying, but you have to really put your best, your ideal situation backed up by your due diligence, showing how you've arrived at that in that conclusion that this is how big you can scale it based on your network, your partnerships, the people in your team, your advisors, all of this. The sales you've had, or the pilot that you've done, and the outcomes, for the, you know, the analytics that show what the outcomes are from your pilot, and then put your best foot forward, and say this is the sort of ideal. This is what we're going for. This is where this is who we are. This is what we believe we can do in the world. Whether you actually can do it or not, we'll see. But it's just like investors. I think I read an article in I think it was an HBR, Harvard Business Review. That's 83% of the term sheets that investors write for startups, the technology they write it for, or product or service, changes by the time they actually get it into the market. And so nobody's expecting you to, you know, show up exactly the way you're saying and reach it, but they want to know that you have a vision and a plan of how to get there, and that's big enough so that the investor can make, you know, they want to make, you know, a lot. They want to make 10 to 30 times their money. I mean, they're not just, they have to believe you can do it.
Yeah.
On a scale that'll actually have some chance of giving them the profit they want.
There's two things that I thought about when you were talking about cultural differences and presenting your vision and ideas. And one thing is that an often question is, where do you see yourself in 5 years, in 10 years, which is a reasonable question, but an unrealistic one when you think about how much the companies change
right.
over time, and oftentimes they don't even have a clue about where they're going to be in five
right.
years in reality, because
right.
it's unpredictable.
Right. Right. So what that is about, it's just, you know, you're just making up fiction, everybody knows it. But what they're actually asking is, do you have a vision and a plan of how to get there? And they know that you're not going to actually end up there. You might end up somewhere else, or, you know, maybe by some miracle you will. But it's not. It's the idea that you've thought through where you want to be on a scale that sounds plausible, reasonable to the venture capitalist who's listening to you.
Mm.
It's a possibility. They also want to know that you're coachable. So venture capitalists want to give you advice and mentors or suggestions. They want to know that you can hear and listen to them. Doesn't mean you have to accept all their advice, but they want to know that you're open to being helped in a way that they think they can help you. And, you know, the personality, quote-unquote, sort of profile personality of the investor needs to match the profile and personality of the company as closely as possible. And the company needs to be clear about what they need from the investor, and the investor has to be the right person to actually provide that. And that's also an issue, because a lot of companies, when they're looking for money, they don't really know what they need, they don't know what a good deal is, they don't, you know, it's...
You mentioned cultural differences and that it's important for a startup to be aware of who they're presenting to and how they will present them. I find that challenging when you know that investors from all over the world are going to different conferences, and then as a startup you are in front of an international audience of investors. So how can you adapt when you have so many different cultures in front of you when you're pitching?
It's just what I said before. They're all looking for the same 10 things for you to cover. So you don't need to adapt. That 1 to 5 minutes is the same everywhere in the world. What you then have to do is once you get the meeting, then you say, okay, oh, you're from Korea. You better know what, how they negotiate in Korea, what's important to them, how to deal, how to, you know, what's considered polite etiquette, all everything. You know, or if they're from Germany, how do they work in Germany? If they're from Slovenia, how do you work in Slovenia? If they're from Spain, it's different. How do you work in Spain, etc. So South Africa, I work in South Africa. You know, that's different than other places. So that's, and you have to understand how companies invest, what their portfolios are like. You have to do research on the people you're talking to. Once, even people in the audience, before you go to a conference, before you do a pitch event, you can do a lot of research on who's going to be there and find out who's in their portfolio, what they're looking for. You know, are they at the end of a funding phase so that they, you know, you don't have a very good, you don't want, really want to come in at the end. And so who are you talking to and what's going on with them?
Okay, so now we can finally also touch the gender issue in startups and technology, in entrepreneurship in general. Around 15% of founders only are women.
15?
Yes.
Well, that's higher than I've heard. I've heard it was 10%. From my experience with these approximately 1,500 companies in the last 5 years, it definitely has not been 10% women. It's been much less.
The European Startup Monitor reports that only 15% of startups in Europe are founded by women. So that's, and you're one, so that's a very good question. What would you say the advantages or disadvantages of women are when it comes to being a founder, being the presenter, and also the investors are mostly male? So what's your advice for female founders when it comes to pitching?
Honestly, there is no advantage to being a woman in pitch. You're at a decided disadvantage. The people you're pitching to are mostly men, largely men, and they want to give money to people that they feel comfortable with who are like them. Women, we're not like them, and we relate to people, many of us, in a different way. And there are things that we do as women unconsciously that are sending men the wrong message, and I have a whole section of what I do that coaches them, the women, to be aware of what those things are and to understand how to modify their delivery, their voice tone, their body language, everything, so that the men can hear them, hear the message without being distracted by things that the women don't even know they're unconsciously conveying. And I don't even mean, it's not even sexual, it's not sexual things even, it's just when we listen to other people, when we're talking to them, a lot of women tend to shake their head up and down like you're doing to me right now. And because you're encouraging people, you're saying, okay, yes, I'm listening. I'm trying to engage and make sure that I feel comfortable. And it's something we do sort of naturally. Not all women, but many of us do. And men don't do that. The vast majority of men don't shake their heads up and down like that. So it's the thing about mirroring how men handle themselves when they're listening, etc., as if you're pitching as a woman, and it's how you, what you do with your voice also. When I was 23, my voice was an octave higher than it is now, and I worked for the Department of Energy in Washington, D.C., and they wanted to send me around to engineering companies that were creating renewable energy technologies in the U.S. and invite them to join our government program that would help them go overseas to Brazil and South America and the Caribbean and form joint ventures with other government bodies, actually, in other countries. And so they trained me when I was 23 on a video camera. And I looked back at the video, and I saw that my voice was an octave higher than it is now. And I sounded like I was a six-year-old little girl. And I had short hair, and I had bangs or fringe. And I kept shaking my head to the side, sort of like in a jerking motion to shake my hair out of my eyes. And it looked like I had Tourette's syndrome. So those were two things that I was doing that were extremely distracting. Was I at all aware of either of them? No. And so I spent 6 months lowering my voice to where it is now. And then I grew my hair out, so it's long. I mean, I've done research and studied men versus women in the business environment. I spent a year course studying that, and now I bring some of that to my clients so that I can talk to the women as a man couldn't to explain to them, this is what you're doing, this is what I think you should do, this is what has to be modified. For each woman, it's different. So I had one woman, she was working in a biotech company, and she was their business development person. She was short, she was like 4'11", 5 feet, I don't know how many centimeters that is, it's short. It's like 145. And she was really curvy, well-developed bust. And she wore super high heels. And when she talked, she had short hair curly up to here. And when she talked, she'd sort of bobble her head sideways while she was talking. And she had a high voice. She looked like one of those little dolls in the cars in the U.S. that the heads just go like that, with wave, like that. And she sounded like this little girl. No one took her seriously. So I coached her, and we just changed everything. And she got promoted. She changed her whole. She had to work. She had to talk to men all the time about the science of what they were doing. She knew what she was talking about, but she wasn't believable. So there's a lot of things that women. And I run across a lot of young women who resent the fact that they have to change themselves in order to be taken seriously. But you know, too bad. That's the way it is. Once they have their first billion, they can set it up and run it the way they want. But it doesn't work that way. There's a lot of prejudice against women, not because they're even necessarily conscious of it. There's a lot of unconscious things that people want to be with people like them. The whole venture capitalist world is a sort of an old boys club. And, you know, that's the way. It's a boys club. It's not a women's club. So I know a lot of women's groups that are forming separate women's clubs. And there's an awareness now that like there wasn't before. I mean, last year it's been really much more aware. And, you know, what happened at Uber is, you know, going to affect things, but...
Do you think it's going to? Do you think that the conversation is going to turn into meaningful consequences? Or is it just, you know, a scandal that's going to be forgotten very quickly?
I don't know. I know that there's probably going to be a lot of resentment about the fact that, you know, they're going to have to change the culture of the men. I don't think they're going to be happy about it. And maybe they will change, maybe they won't. I don't know. But I know that I read an article about a woman founder in San Francisco. I read it about a year ago. And she, I don't remember what her technology was, I don't remember, but the fact is that she had a really viable technology in whatever field she was in. She had, you know, some advisors, she had everything going for her. But then she got pregnant. And so she was pitching while she was pregnant. She couldn't raise any money. She had to give up her company. And she had some traction in the market. It was really a good... I don't remember the details of it, but I remember the pregnancy. And she ended up having to give up. It was just a heart-wrenching article. It was really detailed about what she went through. And you could tell that she had... If she'd been a man, I think it would have totally taken off.
That's another problem, that a lot of times women design solutions meant for women, and that's difficult.
Men they can't understand it. It's not a problem that they can relate to, so they don't fund it, right? That's why they have to pitch to women. But I have to tell you that I've had some venture capital women who have been the most difficult, harsh people in terms of acting like a man themselves, in terms of how they give their feedback to women and others. And they're harder on the women than the men are sometimes. I don't appreciate that. Not all of them, but some of them.
So women do have more work to do usually?
Well, yeah, it's a very uphill. We say in English, the deck is stacked against them, big time.
So what's your experience? You're a woman, you're an entrepreneur. How did you came to where you are today?
That's an interesting question. I think part of it is I've always worked my whole life, and I've always supported my family. And I was a single mother raising my kids, and I had to make things work. And I've been pretty fearless in terms of jumping in to do when I wanted to change my life. I would just figure out how to do it. And a lot of things about women is that they don't do that. They don't generally women in corporate world. The difference, like men, they see there's a position they want. They just don't worry about whether they've got the background, the experience, whatever. They're just going to do that. Women are more perfectionists in general, and they say, "Well, I need to know more in order to do that." I've never been like that, like the women. I've been like the men. So if I see something that I want to do or decide, I just go do it, and I figure out how to do it afterwards. And I've done that a number of times, changing my life and my careers. And I moved to Europe 5.5 years ago after working in California as an executive consultant and facilitator and presentation coach and then pitch coach for tech companies. A couple years before I moved here, I started doing pitch coaching, taking my presentation coaching that I had I used to work in architect firms, engineering firms, healthcare firms, coaching them on their pitches, their interviews, for huge projects. So 400 million, 1.2 billion, 1.6 billion. And I'd travel with the team and coach them way beforehand, then travel with them and coach them as before. And then they used to win really big projects. And then I transferred that ability to do that training and coaching to the tech world because it's just a similar idea, but just a different set of criteria that you have to look forward towards. But I decided to move to Europe because my two kids had been moved to Europe, were in school in UK at the University of St. Andrews and Brunel, and I knew they weren't going to come back. And I had lived in France my junior year of university. I'd been went to the Sorbonne. I loved it. I loved living in France. But I just decided, and I wanted to come back to Europe, so once my kids were here, I decided I'm moving. And I had just pitch coached at the Dutch consulate in San Francisco 16 teams that I'd helped bring over, identified and brought over to Silicon Valley. And I coached them, and there were 14 of the teams that I coached. And they pitched to investors, and they had got three investors. They got investors interested in three teams of this 14 teams, this is the third year they'd had the conference. They'd never done it before. I mean, they never had investors interested in anything they'd done before. And they really got excited. And I made some contacts there, and I've been wanting to move to Europe, a handful. And I just decided 3 months later, I'm moving. So I moved, and I had two or three names I knew, and I'm American, I'm a networker. And what happened is I come from California, Silicon Valley, and I've been working for myself for, decades, 25 years or so, changing what I'm doing, depending on where my interests lay and what happens in my life. I combine my Silicon Valley focus, so I just went and talked to tons of venture capitalists and found out what they needed, reframed what I've been doing for years in terms of presentation and pitch coaching. And when I came to Europe, I was successful at it because I also, because I speak French and Spanish fluently, and I'd been learning some Dutch, and I'd lived in France. I'd also lived in Ecuador, for 8 months, worked there. And then I went to Amsterdam. I lived in Amsterdam for 4 years. And I can sort of cross cultures, and I can see what is blocking people in different cultures. I've done research about different cultures and understand task orientation of certain cultures versus relationship orientation and what gets in people's way. I've done a lot of different things in my life that I've put into the pitch coaching. So I'd been a dance teacher. I was taught salsa, so how people move their bodies when they're dancing together. I watched that. And I it's called a graphic facilitator, where you go to these big meetings and you draw on the wall, it's on paper, the essence, metaphors and color and images and words, the essence of what's happening in the meeting, which means you have to develop an ability to listen to the essence of what they're saying. So you've got to listen, what's the key ideas? Well, when I'm pitch coaching someone, You can put 20 people in front of me. They do a one-minute pitch, and I can give you in 1 minute after feedback exactly what's missing, what isn't missing. I read their body language, their voice tone. I'm a classically trained violinist. I have a very good ear. I'm an artist. There's a lot of things that I've developed and done in my life that I then bring into coaching someone. And, and it works. You know, it works.
Yeah, the diversity of experience.
Right.
That's another difference between Europeans and Americans, or at least Slovenians and Americans. Americans are, you can be wherever you want kind of people. So you can change career 10 times in 10 years if that's necessary. Whereas in Europe, when you're deciding which university or high school you're going to be, you know, it's like a lifetime decision.
Locked in,
yes.
But in the U.S., it's not that easy. 10 times in 10 years is an exaggeration.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people who aren't capable of changing like that. I am, you know, because my family modeled that for me. My father was an engineer, chemical engineer, then became an aerospace engineer. Then he was 39. He went to law school. And he went to law school at 39 years old before anybody was that old doing it. He was the very first wave of the older people going to school. So that I saw that, oh, he wanted to change his life, and he did. And my mom was a teacher her whole life. So when I grew up and I wasn't that clear what I wanted to do, I tried one thing. I worked for the government for 6 years and didn't like that. And then I started working in banking and international marketing for a couple of years. Hated that. And then I started my own art business, and I was an art dealer for a few years where I was in sales. And I built up my sales. I became profitable, and I hired people. Had people I had to hire and manage. Ended up doing some other sales job. I had 100 people working under me. But then I started doing the facilitation and executive consulting, and started getting trained in that, and then getting work doing that. And then I realized that the marketing part of it, in terms of presentation coaching, was something I was really good at. And then I just adapted it for the tech world. And it doesn't matter what technology, it doesn't matter what product, what service, I can help people, you know, articulate what their value is, no matter what. And I've worked at, you know, Yale Quantum Institute for quantum physicists. It doesn't matter, you know.
One of the often talked about things in entrepreneurship is also failure. Maybe from your experience, what was your biggest failure, and how did that influence you?
I've had a few monumental, enormous failures in my life. And one, I worked as a consultant for an architect firm in San Francisco, off and on for 10 years. And I'd been working for them, helping them, coaching them to design healthcare, you know, hospitals. They worked for them like 17 days a month out of 20 working days a month as a consultant for a couple of years. I mean, a few months for that intensely, and then a little less, and then another three or four months that intensely. So I was in the middle of an intense thing like that. And I got fired overnight. They'd just done a merger with another architect firm in another city. I'd just gone up and sort of did the meeting that brought the two companies together, sort of clarifying, you know, their cultures, with how they communicate, how it's going to work. The head guy of my company that I had worked for said I was their secret weapon, that they knew that because of me that they would have really good communication and things were going to work well together in their merger. And then the next night I got home and I got in an email, he had fired me. I made a big mistake. I only had one client. And that's what you should never do. So there's a lot of things I learned the hard way.
Yeah, sometimes that's the only way you can learn.
Yeah, well, I think I could have learned that some other way than having that happen to me. But, you know, I was a single mom. I had two kids. It was really hard. And, yeah. So
how do you find living in Europe compared to the U.S.?
I love it here. Oh, my God. I'm never going back to the U.S. ever. I love living here. I live in Spain now, in just south of Barcelona, in Sitges, right on the Mediterranean. And it's just people, the values of Europeans are aligned with my values. So And in the U.S. in general, they're not anymore. And when I moved here 5.5 years ago to Europe, I could see it and feel it. I thought, uh-oh, this country does not feel like it's my country anymore. It doesn't feel good. And so when I came to Europe, you know, people here, you know, they believe that everybody should have access to a decent job and have education and have healthy living situation, have food, that you should be able to have some pension, retirement, that you have access to health care, and it shouldn't bankrupt you to do that. And that's sort of your right as a human being, as a European citizen. Now, it's uneven. Not everybody has the same access that certain countries have in Europe. I know that. And, you know, I know Europeans are really upset with the big bureaucracy in Brussels, and it's not perfect. But I coached two organizations in Europe. One's it's the EIT, European Institute of Innovation and Technology. So it's like they wanted to be the MIT of Europe, and they funded an EIT health kick. It's a knowledge and innovation community. So I coached a team to win 2.1 billion euro for that, to improve the health of Europeans over 7 years, and to develop new technologies, new innovations, collaborate citizens groups, give people an awareness of how to manage their health better and get more control, and extend the life of Europeans by 2 years on average. That was the whole thing. So when I coached them, it was, you know, the values were that they want to make life better for all Europeans. And then I also coached another group for the EIT food, and they won 1.6 billion when I coached them, and it was to improve the quality of food, improve the transparency of the food supply chain, to reduce the waste in Europe. 30% of food's wasted. They want to cut it in half within a very few years, like I think it was by 2030, I think. I've coached hundreds of climate clean tech companies across Europe that are part of the EIT climate kick that are also looking at developing technologies to have innovation in climate. And Europe's way ahead of the rest of the world in doing that. I know China's now pouring tons of money into it, but, you know, you guys have been putting money where your mouth is, meaning you believe that there's a climate issue, and there's enormous climate issues, you're right, and you've been doing something about it with big time, and sure, it doesn't always work well, there's things that are unfair, countries are a little tense with each other sometimes. But basically, you want to improve people's lives, and you want to improve the planet. That's what the values are.
So you're staying here for good.
And my children are here. My children are in London. My son just moved to Cambridge with his wife and child, and my daughter just moved back to London from New York. She works for a Dutch company.
Is this your first time in Slovenia?
Yes, I've never been here before. I love it.
So you're coming back as well?
I want to so badly. I wish I could be here longer. I'm going to come back. It's beautiful here. The people are so lovely. And the quality of life and the standard of living is quite high. It's really, people love it here. You're all happy. The people I've met, everybody likes it.
So maybe that could be your next home.
I called my daughter. I said, you know what? I want to get some other home here. That's what I told her. I said, I like it so much. And I love the mountains. I'm on the water, right? So it'd be great. The only thing I have to solve for is that from Barcelona, it took me 11 hours to get here flying through Istanbul. And I need to find a shorter route. So I'm going back. It's much shorter. I'm going through Munich. But anyway, that's the only negative. How long it takes to get here.